Hello, and welcome to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for November 24th, 2023. I'm your reader, Haley Nichols. Your top article today, State Report, Sioux City Nodland and Sunnyside continue to be high-performing schools in the Iowa School Performance Profile. Author Caitlin Yamada. Sioux City schools saw some stability and some changes in school performance according to a new state report. Nodland and Sunnyside Elementary Schools were rated as high-performing schools, the same as last year according to the Department of Education's 2022 and 2023 Annual Accountability Report. Most Sioux City schools remained consistent in ranking, while others saw movement up and down. The Iowa School Performance Profile gives each school a rating based on factors that include standardized test scores, attendance, staff retention, and expulsion and suspension rates. Schools receive a score of up to 100 and are placed in one of six rating categories: exceptional, high-performing, commendable, acceptable, needs improvement, and priority. Nodland and Sunnyside Elementary both received a 63.39, a slight increase from the 62.08 received last year. Nodland did not have enough variables to calculate a valid index score and was given a score based on Sunnyside, according to the IDE. Sunnyside Elementary, home to 262 third through fifth grade students, scored above the average in all math and English areas. Vibe Academy was again ranked in the bottom 4% of schools in Iowa. Vibe received a priority rating and a score of 40.4, an increase from the 33.41 received last year. With an enrollment of 332 K-12 students, the Academy's test scores showed below average scores in English, math, and science. The school also reported below average attendance, below average graduation, and higher than average chronic absenteeism. Vibe's math proficiency score was 36.49% compared to the state average of 69.5%. The percentage of Vibe students proficient in language arts was 57.35% compared to the state average of 71.4%. The Virtual Institute for Brighter Education, Sioux City's virtual school, was approved by the Department of Education in February 2021 during the COVID-19 pandemic. The 2021-2022 school year was the first full year of operation. Many other virtual schools in Iowa ranked in the bottom 5%, including Cedar Rapids Virtual Academy, Iowa Virtual Academy, Des Moines Virtual Campus, Marshalltown Virtual Academy, Mason City Virtual Academy, Olwine Online School, and Shenandoah's Ignite Online and Personalized Learning. Most of the district's schools fall into the acceptable category. Many other of the district's schools fall into the needs improvement and commendable rankings. Irving Elementary again moved up in rankings. Last year, Irving was rated as needing improvement. This year, they have moved into the acceptable category. Irving received a score of 50.64, a 4.44 point increase from the previous year. With an enrollment of 634 K through 5th grade students, the test scores showed below average test scores in English and math. The dual language school has a high percentage of English language learners, causing the percentage of students proficient in English language arts to be 43.86%, below the 71.4 state average, but an increase from the 35.08 proficient last year. The English language learner students performed better than the state average in both language arts and mathematics. Irving English learners were 27.72% proficient in English, compared to the state average of 21.68%. Irving Elementary, Leeds Elementary, Los Hills Elementary, and Spalding Elementary all increased compared to last year. Morningside Elementary, Unity Elementary, and Bryant Elementary decreased. All of the Sioux City schools ranked as follows. No Sioux City school ranked as exceptional. Sunnyside Elementary and Nodland Elementary ranked as high performing. Leeds Elementary, Spalding Park Elementary, Perry Creek Elementary, and Los Hills Elementary ranked as commendable. Liberty Elementary, Irving Elementary, North High, East High, Unity Elementary, Hunt Elementary, East Middle, and Riverside Elementary ranked as acceptable. North Middle, West High Morningside Elementary, West Middle, and Byrant Elementary ranked as needs improvement, and Vibe ranked as priority. The Sergeant Bluff, Luton schools all ranked as commendable with above average proficiency in math and English language arts. Sergeant Bluff High School dropped from high performing to commendable. The scores are a tool for families, educators, and others to understand how schools are performing, but they do not give the full story, Iowa Department of Education Director Ann Lebo said previously. Of the 468 total schools identified in need of targeted assistance and support, nearly half of all were identified because their students with disabilities performed below the level of the lowest 5% of all schools, according to the Iowa Department of Education. While the Iowa School Performance Profile does not tell the full story about schools, the website provides important data to help schools with their improvement planning, identifying supports to address high needs areas, and improving students' outcomes going forward, Lebo said previously. Our next article today, Lamar's prepares for its annual Christmas in a hometown celebration by Earl Horlick. Most people wouldn't confuse the ice cream capital of the world with the North Pole, but Santa Claus and a herd of reindeer will be among the special guests at Christmas in hometown Lamar's on Saturday. The man, aka Kris Kringle, is making his presence felt in various locations in the Plymouth County seat, while Rudolph and his pals will be part of a petting zoo situated on Central Avenue during the fourth annual event that coincides with Small Business Saturday. The day-long celebration was the brainchild of Cheryl Wells, owner of Habichu Coffee House and Bakery, who always enjoyed taking in the sights of the large lit Christmas tree and skating rink at Rockefeller Center with her husband Mike Wells, longtime CEO of Wells Enterprises, whenever the couple vacationed in New York. I loved how everybody turned out for the lighting of a giant Christmas tree, Cheryl Wells said with a smile. I remember telling Mike that we can do something similar in Lamar's. In fact, we could do it better. Unfortunately, the maiden year for Christmas in hometown Lamar's was in 2020, when all outdoor events were limited to 30 people due to COVID-19 concerns. We live-streamed the tree lighting ceremony, but it wasn't the same thing, she admitted. The event didn't really take off until year two. That was when the day expanded to include a Santa 5K 10K run, fun run, a Christmas carnival, food vendors, a craft corner, barbershop quartets, a scavenger hunt, and even special performances by the Lamar's-based gospel singing Brown family from their own Brown Century Theater. It all leads to a 6 p.m. Saturday lighting ceremony of a 26-foot Christmas tree and to a concert by the Browns, Sioux City-based singer Jill Miller, and the Galen Catholic and Lamar's Community High School choirs, all at the Olson Cultural Events Theater, 33 First Street Southeast. In fact, there are so many things going on, Margaret Catton has problems keeping track of things. We have a calendar that charts the weeks and days before Christmas in hometown Lamar's, Catton, who is the event's executive committee, explained. When it gets down to hours, you know we're getting close. That is certainly good news for Mike Wells, who said the event has turned into the most profitable day for Lamar's businesses. It is exactly why we connected the celebration to Small Business Saturday, he said. Lamar's is such a great community, and our Christmas activities showcase both the citizens and the city at its best. Catton agreed, noting the day attracted many out-of-towners. They might come for the fun activities, but they'll stick around for shopping, she said. As Christmas in hometown Lamar's drew near, Mike Wells discussed all of the new events slated for this year. We're putting in a skating rink behind the Cultural Events Center. A live nativity will be going up soon, and families will be able to have photos taken in front of giant inflatables. Indeed, much of Lamar's, a town of 10,500, is already looking festive for the holidays. What drew us to Christmas at Rockefeller Center was that it drew people together to experience something joyful, Cheryl Wells said. Christmas in hometown Lamar's wouldn't have worked unless we had buy-in from the entire community. The community has come together in a big way, and you can truly feel the Christmas spirit in Lamar's, she added. Our next article from Lee Digital Content Center, Data Herald, is Cooking at Home is More Expensive Than It's Ever Been. Check the cost of groceries in the Midwest. Egg prices cracked a new ceiling in 2022, rising a record 32.2% over the previous year's prices. While the 20-year historical level of retail food price inflation is 2% per year, last year inflation across almost all food categories shot up nearly 10%. According to the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the USDA, the cost of groceries rose by an average of 11.4% in 2022 and is expected to increase by another 10% in 2023. Never mind the cost of eating in restaurants, cooking at home is as expensive as it has ever been. Good home cooking allows home cooks to simplify meal preparation, produce tastier food, and save money. As an added benefit, home-cooked food tends to be much healthier than restaurant or takeout food. Since the cook is in complete control of the fat, sugar, and salt content. Here are some of the recent costs of food and beverages in the U.S. and the Midwest. Cereals and baked products have increased more than any other food product over the last year and are steady at 5%. Dairy and related products show the lowest increase, and fruits and vegetables do show a decrease over the last few months. Alcoholic beverage inflation has risen more than non-alcoholic beverage and beverage materials over the last 5 months and have hit 6% inflation rates. The cost of bread has steadily increased over the year, and in the Midwest sits at just under $2. The cost of a chicken breast has steadily increased over the year, and in the Midwest sits in between $4.2 and $4.4. The cost of ground beef has risen the most for the western part of the United States, but for all parts of the United States has risen steadily. And here in the Midwest, sits at just over $4.80 a pound. And the cost of milk has risen again steadily for all of the United States, but the Midwest has seen the most relief as it is at $3.50 compared to the rest of the nation, which is up close to $3.80. Today's Sioux City Journal poll, Are You Planning to Go Black Friday Shopping? By Jared McNett. The poll, Are You Planning to Go Black Friday Shopping? Is open, and the answer to yesterday's poll, Have You Seen the Sioux City Turkeys Before? Total votes were 51, with 41 of those people saying yes, they had seen those turkeys. In the crime section of the paper, the headline reads, Lakeview Police Seeking Information About Missing Man, by Dolly Butts. The Lakeview Police Department is seeking the public's help to find a missing man. The department said in a post to its Facebook page that 53-year-old David Schultz has been missing since Tuesday. He was last heard from in the early morning hours of Tuesday, according to the post. Anyone who has seen or heard from Schultz is asked to contact the department at 712-657-2513. Also in headlines, Woman Settles Malpractice Lawsuit Against Sioux City Law Firm, by Nick Hytrek. A Sergeant Bluff woman who said a Sioux City law firm's action handling her lawsuit were negligent has settled a malpractice lawsuit against the firm and her former lawyers. Jessica McHugh's attorney, Timothy Clausen, has filed a dismissal of the lawsuit against Guzman Law Firm, Joel Carney, William Hale, and Jenna Guzman. Clausen said details of the settlement are confidential and he was unable to comment on it. McHugh sued the firm and the lawyers in August of 2022 in Woodbury County District Court, saying her lawsuit against a plastic surgeon was dismissed after her lawyers missed a filing deadline. She said in the lawsuit that Guzman Law Firm had exaggerated its claims about its lawyers' health care law experience, and her lawyers had breached their duties by filing an affidavit more than 4 months past its due date. The missed deadline resulted in the dismissal of McHugh's lawsuit against the doctor. The firm and the lawyers said in their answer to the lawsuit they had acted in good faith and believed they were complying with the law while representing her. McHugh had been seeking a judgment awarding her an unspecified amount of damages for past and future medical expenses, lost wages, pain and suffering, permanent disfigurement, and legal fees. Updated, Taylor found guilty on all 52 counts of voter fraud by Nick Heitrich. With verdicts for 52 charges marked in a thick packet before him, Chief U.S. District Judge Leonard Strand could have announced the verdict for each charge one by one. Instead, he shortened the suspense, telling those gathered in the courtroom to hear the verdict in Kim Taylor's voter fraud trial that he summarized the jury's decision. It didn't take long. After roughly 6 hours of deliberations, the jury on Tuesday found Taylor, the wife of Republican Woodbury County Supervisor Jeremy Taylor, guilty on all 52 charges, 26 counts of providing false information in registering and voting, 3 counts of fraudulent registration, and 23 counts of fraudulent voting. During the 2020 primary and general elections, Taylor, a Vietnam native, approached numerous Vietnamese voters with limited English comprehension and filled out and signed election forms and ballots on behalf of them and their English-speaking children. It was all part of a scheme, government prosecutors said through the 6-day trial, to stuff the ballot box for her husband, who ran unsuccessfully for the Republican nomination for a U.S. House seat in the 2020 primary before winning election to the Woodbury County Board of Supervisors that fall. No one testified to seeing Kim Taylor personally sign any of the documents, but her presence in each voter's home when the forms were filled out was the common thread through the case. "We were definitely confident in the evidence we put forward. We are delighted, to say the least," Assistant U.S. Attorney Ron Timmons, one of the prosecutors who presented the federal government's case, said of the verdict. Jeremy Taylor, who met his wife while teaching in Vietnam, has not been charged, but has been named as an unindicted co-conspirator. The case remains under investigation, and Timmons said he couldn't comment on any potential future indictments. Kim and Jeremy Taylor, neither of whom showed a visible reaction upon hearing the verdict, quickly left the courthouse afterwards. "Now is a time for empathy for a family that is suffering," Kim Taylor's attorney F. Montgomery Brown said. "This is how we solve controversies in America, with a jury, not with violence. We respect the jury's verdict and appreciate the jury's service. We'll move on to sentencing and try to get the best outcome at sentencing and assess any appellate decisions after sentencing." Taylor faces up to 5 years in prison on each charge. Prosecutors did not request she be detained, so Strand ordered she will remain free on release until sentencing, which will be scheduled after the U.S. Probation Office completes a pretense investigation. She was ordered to surrender her passport at the time of her arrest and prohibited from applying for a new one. She has 14 days to file a request for a new trial. Brown likely will renew his motion for a judgment of acquittal, and Strand, who previously reserved ruling on it, asked Brown and the prosecution to file written briefs on the matter. "Taylor committed fraud on a scale rarely seen," prosecutors said. "Most voter fraud cases involve one voter casting a single ballot in another person's name," said Assistant U.S. Attorney Richard Evans, who helped prosecute Taylor's case. Despite what's in the media, voter fraud is extremely rare, Evans said. To have someone vote dozens of times for several people, that is rare. Woodbury County election officials became aware of possible voter fraud in September 2020 when two Iowa State University students from Sioux City requested absentee ballots, only to learn ballots had already been cast in their name. They were allowed to withdraw those ballots and cast their own. But Woodbury County Auditor Pat Gill, who also is election commissioner, kept the fraudulent ballots. When processing absentee ballots on election night, election workers notified Gill the handwriting on the number of them appeared to be similar. After the election, Gill notified the FBI, which launched an investigation, and Taylor was indicted and arrested in January. At trial, five voters who had immigrated from Vietnam and speak very little English testified through a translator that Taylor had frequently visited their homes to help them fill out voter registration forms, absentee request forms, and absentee ballots for them, and told them they could complete and sign forms for their children without their consent. One man said he'd hand over all the blank forms to Taylor, who would leave with them. Eight young adults, the sons and daughters of a granddaughter of those five witnesses, who were all born in Sioux City and speak English, each testified they had never given consent for their parents to fill out election forms for them, and all were unaware they had done so. Many of them said they had never voted. In one case, two of the men hadn't lived in Sioux City for several years, yet voter registration forms, absentee requests, and ballots bearing their mother's Sioux City address were filed in their name. None of the witnesses, however, ever saw Taylor, who did not testify at trial, sign any of the documents, they said when Brown cross-examined them for the defense. In his closing argument to the jury, Brown said the government had presented no evidence of Taylor's guilt and the FBI hadn't bothered to have handwriting experts examine the documents to determine if Taylor had indeed signed them. The government countered that Taylor had met with all of the families who testified, had helped them fill out papers, collected them, and dropped them off at the courthouse to be processed. The evidence pointed in the direction of Kim Taylor, Timmons said. In other state news, a top story, Fisher, other senators embrace AI on the farm, iProvisions in Farm Bill, by Ellen Ferguson. Artificial intelligence is already a workhorse in the technology that allows tractors to identify weeds and tailor herbicide spraying, determine when a crop is ready to harvest, and weave together satellite and soil data to make efficient use of fertilizer. But Senate Agricultural Committee members said last week that AI's potential to bring more advances in agriculture comes with risks regarding farm data protection, the affordability of technology, particularly for small farms, consolidation in the sector, and other unforeseen consequences. Senator John Thune, a Republican from South Dakota, said the committee and Congress will have to balance policies that encourage innovation but protect against excesses. He told witnesses that he is working on legislation to put up guardrails while maintaining a light touch on regulations. One witness at the panel's hearing urged senators to include provisions in the farm bill that would allow farmers to get loans from the Agricultural Department that would encourage adoption of AI and precision technology. Agricultural Chairwoman Debbie Stabenow, a Democrat from Michigan, suggested that such provisions looked likely. Lawmakers have passed a continuing resolution that extended the 2018 Farm Bill to September 30, 2024. The bill expired on September 30th, and the extensions give Congress time to write a new Farm Bill. The House passed the CR on Tuesday, and the Senate passed it on Wednesday. Jose Marie Griffiths, president of Dakota State University in South Dakota, which has a focus on AI, cyber, and quantum computing, called for a measured approach on regulation. I do believe strongly in a lighter touch than heavy-duty regulation, because the moment regulation gets to be too much, Innovation shrinks naturally, Griffiths said. I think it is important that we ensure that innovation can occur, but at the same time have these guardrails to mitigate risks. Stabenow and Ranking Member John Boozman, a Republican from Arkansas, convened the hearing to delve into the potential promise and peril of AI in food production, processing, and related areas. The hearing follows several special briefings open to all senators on the broad use of artificial intelligence and an October 30th presidential executive order directing federal department and agencies to promote AI use while also ensuring the technology is safe and free of bias. Stabenow, who used AI to write part of her opening statement, said the technology opens new pathways to address the climate crisis, increase production, lower input costs, and automate planning and harvesting. But she also cautioned that placing vast amounts of data in the hands of a few private companies could accelerate the trend of consolidation in the agricultural industry or perpetuate bias that has harmed small farmers and farmers of color for decades. Boozman also had words of caution. While AI holds great potential, we should ask tough questions about the potential risks, he said. Senator Deb Fischer, Republican from Nebraska, said lack of access to reliable, high-speed internet services is a major hurdle for farmers and ranchers who might be willing to shoulder technology costs. Fischer and Senator Ben Ray Lujan, a Democrat from New Mexico, have legislation that would establish a USDA program with a mission to make broadband available to farmers and ranchers so they can use precision agriculture as they work in remote fields. Fisher and other USDA broadband efforts focus on reaching households or businesses. Jami Hinman, Senior Vice President and Chief Technology Officer for Deere & Company, said the next farm bill should include provisions from the legislation as well as from another bill from Fisher and Senator Amy Klobuchar, Democrat from Minnesota, that would set up a USDA loan program to cover the cost of precision technology. Hinman said the provisions were essential for farmers to fully leverage the benefits of AI and precision technologies. Stabenow agreed, telling Fisher that she and Boozman had discussed her legislation and having your work become part of what we're doing in the farm bill. Senators Peter Welsh, Democrat Vermont, and Lujan raised questions about access to AI products for small or non-English-speaking producers. It's an opportunity for bigger ag where you can spread the costs over time, but for a lot of smaller producers, there's a lot of skepticism about whether they can get a return on investment, Welch said. With the entry cost, how can we do things that will help the smaller farmers when they are not going to be able to take that risk with the higher upfront costs? Mason Earls, an assistant professor at University of California, Davis, who is part of the AI Institute for Next Generation Food Systems, said small farmers could use AI as a tool for helping them make decisions about their operations, much in the way they have worked with the USDA extension agents. Earls also said smartphones could be a lower cost way to use some AI systems without the overhead costs of more complex technology. I think there is an opportunity for using things people already own. Our phones are loaded with many types of sensors. We may not realize it, but there are probably 15 different types of sensors in your camera. So I think there is an opportunity for smaller farmers, he said. Lujan asked about the ease of Spanish-speaking farmers or workers making the use of AI products in the U.S. Earls, who has founded an agricultural startup, said the market shouldn't be ignored. If someone is not doing this, then the technology is not going to penetrate the market, he said, adding that not adapting creates an obstacle. If there is not an effort to make Spanish first or at least bilingual in those tools, especially specialty crops where we have predominantly Spanish-speaking workers. You have been listening to the reading of the Sioux City Journal for November 24th, 2023. Today is Friday. This is the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind, or IRIS. Now, let's turn to today's obituaries. Obituary for Stephen Gene Murphy, Jr. The funeral home is Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, 3220 Stone Park Boulevard, Sioux City, Iowa. The upcoming service visitation will be held November 26, 2023, from 2 p.m. to 6 p.m. at Holy Cross Parish, Michael's Catholic Church. Stephen Gene Murphy, Jr., February 5, 1976 to November 19, 2023. Stephen Gene Murphy, Jr., 47, of Sioux City, passed away on Sunday, November 19, 2023, at his home, comforted by family. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 10 a.m. Monday, November 27, 2023, at Holy Cross Parish, St. Michael's Catholic Church in Sioux City, with Father Peter Nguyen as celebrant. Interment will follow at Calvary Cemetery. Visitation will be on Sunday, November 26, 2023, at the church from 2 p.m. until 6 p.m., with a vigil service beginning at 5 p.m. Online condolences may be offered to the family at MeyerBrothersChapel.com. Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel is assisting the family. Memorials may be directed to the family. Stephen was born on February 5, 1976, in Ada, Oklahoma, to Stephen G. and Deborah L. Powell Murphy. He received his education in Ada, Oklahoma, graduating with the class of 1995. Stephen moved to Phoenix, Arizona in 2000 until 2009, and then to Sioux City in 2009. He married Alyssa L. Jensen on October 20, 2012, at St. Joseph Catholic Church in Sioux City, Iowa. Stephen received his two-year degree from Western Iowa Tech in Police Science in 2014. Stephen worked various jobs over the years where he worked as a server and security. He was currently working at security at Siouxland Community Health Center. He was a proud member of St. Michael's Catholic Church. Stephen is survived by his wife Alyssa of Sioux City, stepson Braylon Benoche of Sioux City, son Colin Murphy of Sioux City, sister Erin Murphy of Marion, Iowa, nephew Stephen Womack, fiance Grace Schlitz of Marion, Iowa, stepsister Mariah Wynn of Okemah, Oklahoma, father and mother-in-law David and Jackie Jensen of Las Vegas, Nevada, mother and father-in-law Deanne and Gary Smith of Sioux City, sister-in-law Angela Jensen of Sioux City, and brother-in-law Alan Jensen of Sioux City. Stephen is preceded in death by his dad, Stephen Murphy Sr., stepdad Andrew Wynn, mother Deborah Wynn, and nephew Joshua Murphy. Casket bearers for the service will be Alan Jensen, Stephen Womack, Braylon Bignoche, Jeremy Johnson, David Powell, and Jim Penzolt. Honorary bearers will be son Colin Murphy, nephew Nathan Jensen, stepfather-in-law Gary Smith, father-in-law David Jensen, and nephew Josh Murphy. Obituary for Orville T. Thiel. Funeral home, Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel, 3220 Stone Park Boulevard, Sioux City, Iowa. Upcoming service visitation is November 25, 2023 at 10 a.m., First Lutheran Church. Orville T. Thiel, 90, of Sioux City, passed away Friday, November 17, 2023. A memorial service will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, November 25, 2023, at First Lutheran Church. Visitation with family present will be 1 hour prior to the service time at the church. Burial will be at a later date at Logan Park Cemetery. Arrangements made by Meyer Brothers Colonial Chapel. Obituary for Alice Lynn Bruns, 1955 to 2023. Funeral home, Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Homes, Mobile. Alice Lynn Bruns, age 68, met her Savior Jesus face to face on Thursday, November 16, 2023, at her home in Sioux City, Iowa. She passed peacefully surrounded by her family. A funeral service will be held on Tuesday, November 21, 2023, at 1 p.m. at her church, Cornerstone World Outreach, 1625 Glen Ellen Road, Sioux City, Iowa, with a Pastor Gary Gordon officiating. Burial will be at the Memorial Park Cemetery of Sioux City. A visitation will be held on Monday, November 20th, 2023, from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. at the church. Come join our family as we celebrate the life of this wonderful woman of God, wife, mother, grandmother, and friend. She is in heaven with the Father, and we hope you get to meet there someday. Come to the service to learn how. The Nicholas D. Jensen Funeral Home of Mobile is charged with the arrangements. Alice was born September 18, 1955, to Alfred K. Davis and Corinne L. Dunnigan, raised in Salix, Iowa, with her seven siblings. Alice is survived by her husband Brian Bruns and her eight children, Chad Bruns, Daisy, David Bruns, Leanne, Elijah Bruns, Allison, Faith Fisher, Peter, Hadassah Hawkworth, Jacob, Isaac Bruns, Carolyn, Joy Cree, Carter, and Liberty Bruns, 26 grandchildren and four of her sisters, Carlin, Rita, Debbie, and Cindy. Alice was preceded in death by her parents, her sixth daughter, Glory Bruns, three of her siblings, Leanne Thompson, Terry Holdgrafer, and Laverne, Skip Davis, and several unborn grandchildren that we know she is snuggling with at this moment. Alice met and married the love of her life and her best friend, Brian Bruns, in 1985. They raised eight children together in Sioux City and were lovingly referred to as the ABC family. Alice's priorities have always been the children, known by her children's friends as Mama Bruns. When her children attended private school, she worked as a custodian and recess monitor. When half of her children worked at the local mall, she got a job at the mall. She knew how to keep an eye on her babies, and no matter their age, she taught and held them accountable to God's word. Alice dedicated her life and her children to God. She and Brian raised their children up in the Lord, Proverbs 22:6. And have served faithfully in their local church for decades, surprising little ones with balloon creations, making beautiful crochet masterpieces for families, organized and managed nursery schedules, and consistently mentored young mothers on ways to raise their children in the Lord, Titus 2. Their strong dedication to each other and living by God's word has produced a beautiful legacy that will continue for generations. She was truly a Proverbs 31 woman. Her children rise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praises her. She is clothed with strength and dignity and laughs without fear of the future. Alice loved deeply and had a full, beautiful life, and she thanked God for daily. She will be missed daily until the time we get to see her and hug her again. Alice was a veteran of the U.S. Air Force. She worked as a lead for several years in the local meatpacking industry, facility maintenance at Heartland Christian, custodial manager at Siouxland Christian, manager of Great American Cookies, and most importantly, the driving force of the Bruns family home. Alice never shied away from home improvement projects, bathroom remodels, attic renovations for her girls, a personal playground and splash pad for her grandkids. She gave of herself all she could when she knew someone was hurting or struggling. She strived to assist. She loved blessing others. Upon retirement, she spent most days with her grandchildren and loved everything that they were interested in. Grandma Alice spoiled her grandchildren endlessly while teaching them the love of God. Online condolences can be made at nicholasdjensenfh.com. That's all the obituaries for today. And for the final part of our reading, I'll finish up with a few opinion pieces. Jerry Davidge, families of addiction come in all shapes and sizes. A grandmother, a teenager, a military veteran, a drug addict. They all have the same thing in common, a loved one whose life has been strangled or snuffed out by addiction. These readers contacted me in response to my recent column about Friends TV star Matthew Perry, my late brother, and hundreds of empty bottles in the wake of their deaths. After reading your article, I felt it would be appropriate to reach out. Families of addiction come in all shapes and sizes, wrote James G. of Glens Falls, New York. I'm a 56-year-old father of a 31-year-old son with addiction. I am a neurosurgeon, and my son's younger brother, who is 27, is an engineer at Tesla. His older son's addiction problems started with smoking pot as a teenager at a skate park, then progressed to OxyContin abuse, and later to heroin. He has been to jail. He has been to rehab 7 times, his father wrote. He has been sober since January, living with other sober individuals, paying rent and working a job from 6 a.m. till 6 or 7 p.m. The simple achievements are often heralded by loved ones of addicts. I love the fact that we have a relationship now with the person I always knew was inside of him, the father wrote. This is a common dynamic within families of addicts, including my family. We are forced to live with 2 versions of our loved ones. This dilemma is especially true for parents who are typically more committed to loving their troubled child. The pain we feel cannot be quantified other than to say that it is only matched by the unconditional love of a parent for a child, James G. wrote. Another reader echoed what many others told me about my late brother Joe. The name Joe could be easily changed to my brother, then changed again to my dad. Same story, same senseless loss of life, same devastating damage affecting all the people in their lives, she wrote. Love them both dearly, and at times hated them too. Although it's been years, I still wonder why. Why them? Why our family? Why not me? I often wondered the same thing about my brother, who took a lot of drugs in a futile attempt to feel better. Billy P., a reader from Iowa, summed up perfectly the deadly relationship between emotional pain and substance abuse. Addiction becomes the uncontrollable response to deal with pain. We all want to manage our sins, thinking somehow we are in charge. Readers showed unexpected empathy toward my brother's demons and surprising compassion for other addicts' troubles. I wanted to tell you how moved I was by your editorial in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. You made your brother come alive in the retelling, wrote Mitris Schaffers from Baldwin, Missouri. Your article that parallels your brother's life with Perry's really engaged me. The description of your many mixed feelings and the effect on other family members is exactly what Perry would have wanted you to write, Cindy Felton wrote. I have never emailed or written a newspaper columnist before, but felt compelled to. I read your article concerning your brother's alcohol drug addiction, and it was so moving and heartfelt. Thank you for sharing so honestly, and may your brother now be at peace, Lori Willis wrote. A reader from Madison, Wisconsin, was one of many people who were shocked by my gift of prescription pills to my brother on this birthday. Your birthday gift of pills was shocking, yet I'm sure I probably gave my brother a bottle of alcohol for Christmas before I realized it was an issue. I just love the way you brought this old age problem to the forefront with a personal touch about your brother and personal experience, she wrote. An Indiana reader told me, in recovery myself for over 20 years, I read it with admiration and appreciation for your reiterating Matthew Perry's statement about the importance of helping others. More than 12 readers stressed the underlying message of my initial column, which remains the same message for today's column. I hope your article encourages others to seek help. Never, never give up, a reader told me. By Jerry DeVich, The New York Times of Northwest Indiana. And we'll end with an opinion piece by Elizabeth Cronin. Give thanks every day. It will make you more resilient. Thanksgiving invites us to reflect on all that is good, which can be challenging amid global and personal suffering. Should we be counting our blessings despite bad news? According to research, the answer is yes. Studies suggest that in times of trouble, an attitude of gratitude is helpful and even healthy. Gratitude increases resilience, which is critical in times of trouble. Other benefits include better sleep, less stress, more positive emotions, and enhanced relationships. People who find things to appreciate tend to be happier, and happier people tend to live longer. Consider the often cited study, Counting Blessings versus Burdens, an experimental investigation of gratitude and subjective well-being in daily life, by Robert A. Emmons and Michael E. McCullough in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology in 2003. Investigators divided 192 American undergraduate students into three groups. The first group was instructed to write down 5 things they appreciated each week for 10 weeks. The second group recorded 5 daily hassles instead. The third group documented neutral events. The results showed that the gratitude group experienced significantly higher levels of happiness and life satisfaction. This suggests that in times of trouble, it's helpful to acknowledge the people and things we take for granted. Doing an inventory of our blessings gives us hope and guides our attitude. In his 1946 book, Man's Search for Meaning, Viktor Frankl, a psychiatrist who survived 3 years in a Nazi concentration camp, explored the power of choosing our attitude. He wrote that amid the problematic and dehumanizing conditions of the concentration camps, those individuals who found meaning in their lives were more likely to survive. The prisoners who were able to see beyond physical circumstances and recall what really mattered overcame despair and persevered. Frankl's story remains popular today as a lesson. While we can't always control external events, we can choose our attitude and response. Finding things that remind us of life's joys doesn't mean closing our eyes to suffering. It means seeing problems and noticing or remembering signs of beauty and love. The COVID-19 pandemic deprived us of social interaction and disrupted our daily routines. Disconnected from the people and places that provide pleasure, many experienced a decline in mental well-being. This was true for students of all ages throughout the United States. In the fall semester of 2020, as the pandemic persisted, 87 Wingate University students participated in a study investigating whether an intervention of gratitude would alleviate this decline. Similar to Emmons and McCullough's approach, the researchers at Wingate placed students in either a gratitude or a control group. For 10 weeks, those in the gratitude group recorded 5 things they were grateful for, while the control group did nothing different. Both groups were evaluated at the beginning and the end of the study. Researchers found that those in the gratitude group improved. They were more likely to endorse feeling optimistic about the future and thinking they were handling their problems well. Those in the control group experienced a further decline in their mental well-being. Even in terrible circumstances, we can choose how we respond. When we focus on the negative, we feel worse. After all, what we pay attention to expands. Take, for example, the health of 2 plants that receive different levels of attention. The one that is watered, fertilized, and cared for thrives, while the one that is neglected withers. If we want to be happier, we need to help positive thinking thrive and allow negative thinking to wither. I suggest practicing gratitude. Regardless of where you are or the time of day, take 5 minutes to find things you appreciate. While it may feel uncomfortable or even mechanical at first, it yields results and gets easier the more you do it. Keep a journal and record 3 to 5 things you are thankful for each day. If you have trouble sleeping, try counting your blessings instead of sheep. Every week, express your appreciation to someone. Go beyond a polite thank you and tell that person how and why their kindness is appreciated. Once a month, set aside time to review and reflect. Briefly note any problems. Then shift your attention to accomplishments, lessons learned, or opportunities for the future. Savor moments of joy. Be patient. It takes time for a habit to feel natural. In the face of things we cannot control, regularly give thanks. It will improve your outlook and health far beyond Thanksgiving. And that does it for today's reading of the Sioux City Journal for Friday, November 24th, 2023. I'm your reader, Haley Nichols. You can access a recording of today's reading on our website, iowaradioreading.org, anytime. Thank you so much for listening.
In the People's Pharmacy Health Headlines. At high doses, nonsteroidal anti-inflammatory drugs like diclofenac, ibuprofen, or naproxen may increase the risk of kidney problems. The study that revealed this used de-identified medical records of more than 750,000 active duty U.S. Army soldiers. Consequently, these were active young and middle-aged adults. During the time of the study, from 2011 through 2014, nearly 18% of these soldiers got a prescription for 1 to 7 doses of an NSAID pain reliever in a month. Another 16% were prescribed more than 7 doses in a month. Fewer than 1% of these people were subsequently diagnosed with acute or chronic kidney disease. Nevertheless, the rate of kidney trouble was about 20% higher among people who had received high-dose NSAIDs than among those who had taken none. The authors described the increased risk as modest but statistically significant.
Another class of drugs that can lead to kidney injury is proton pump inhibitors. A data mining initiative of the FDA's Adverse Event Reporting System analyzed kidney-related side effects among 43,000 people who took a drug such as esomeprazole, lansoprazole, or omeprazole. Approximately 8,000 people taking a histamine 2 blocker such as ranitidine or famotidine served as controls, since they take these drugs for similar symptoms. The researchers found that 5.6% of people on PPIs alone had a kidney-related side effect, while only 0.7% of those on H2 blockers did. Chronic kidney disease was 28 times more likely, and acute kidney injury was 4 times more likely among people taking PPIs. While this analysis shows association, not causation, there are previous studies linking PPIs and kidney damage.
There's growing concern about a mysterious infectious disease that has been spreading among the wild deer population for decades. Scientists call it CWD, or chronic wasting disease. Hunters refer to this condition as zombie deer disease. It can also affect elk and moose. The CDC reports that this infectious disease has spread to wildlife in 24 states and 2 Canadian provinces. CWD was first detected in Colorado among captive deer in the 1960s and in the wild deer population in the 1980s. It's now affecting deer in the Midwest, Southwest, and some parts of the East Coast. The disease appears to be caused by a prion infection reminiscent of mad cow disease. An infectious disease expert at the University of Minnesota has warned that hunters who eat contaminated deer meat may eventually develop the human equivalent of chronic wasting disease.
Shoulder replacement surgery is becoming increasingly common. Now researchers writing in the BMJ say that patients should be warned that the risks are higher than originally thought. The investigators reviewed hospital and mortality records in the UK. When men between 50 and 59 have this type of shoulder surgery, 1 in 4 will need further surgery on that shoulder within 5 years. In addition, older people who underwent this kind of surgical procedure experienced high rates of serious adverse events. 1 in 9 older women and 1 in 5 older men had an infection, major blood clot, heart attack or stroke, or died within 3 months. The authors of the study encouraged their colleagues to counsel patients about the risks as well as the benefits of this kind of surgery.
Drug interactions are a serious hazard in hospitals and the community. If patients receive prescriptions for incompatible medications, they can experience severe side effects that may even be life-threatening. Electronic medical records are intended to warn prescribers and pharmacists about potentially dangerous interactions, but many do so indiscriminately. The result is something called alert fatigue. If clinicians receive too many warnings, they may not pay attention to the really important ones. A team at St. Jude Children's Research Hospital reviewed their alert system. They removed unnecessary alerts and provided additional information to the most important ones. After they finished, they tracked clinicians' reactions. Alert overrides dropped by 40%. One important change linked alerts to the patient's laboratory data, making them much more targeted. And that's the health news from the People's Pharmacy this week.